Hello, this is Louise Hay, and I'm thrilled to have this opportunity to honor my dear friend, Wayne Dyer. I have known Wayne for many years, and I've watched his life work grow and evolve. And I think that the most important thing we can learn from him is to honor our own destiny, our purpose in this life. Wayne is someone who is really living his life on purpose. He is constantly growing and seeking to live a life centered in peace, love, and inner harmony. And I think that's really the key to our existence. When we are on purpose, when we are true to our values, we are happier, more productive, and more open to receive the freedom, compassion, understanding, and love that is our birthright. We are all on a journey towards this thing called enlightenment. And the key to getting there is to know, to really know, that the life you're living will bring you home. And I know that you've chosen the perfect guide in Wayne Dyer.
Volume 2, Finding Your Purpose.
I think we show up here with mission. We have tasks, we have lessons, we have things that we have to do while we're here. And for some of us, that's a very short time. And for some, it's a very long time. And some people will have 30 years experience. And some people will have 1 year experience 30 times. Two different approaches. They endlessly keep repeating the same thing over again, and others are growing. It's not the same for anybody. I just talked to somebody just the other day who's 29 years working at a plant in Indiana. And his real love, he has an apple orchard. He has 290 trees. He knew so much about apples and about all the different kinds of apples and about all the controversy about pesticides and why they have to be used and which ones are safe and which ones aren't and how much water that you have to give them and why you just let nature do it in a certain way and where you plant them and when you harvest them. And he had this whole thing he had discovered about how to keep apples for 6 months by putting them in your refrigerator and keeping them cool, but you've got to keep moisture in there. He said the moisture goes out, and he was so excited about his apples. And yet he spends 99% of his life he's doing something that he doesn't like doing. I said, your bliss is your apples, isn't it? And your apple orchard. Ah, he said, I love it when I'm out there with that. I just feel like I'm with God at that time. I said, is there any way to make this so you don't have to do this other stuff, so that you don't have to spend your life in this sort of inauthentic way where you're always thinking about how much you dislike what you're doing? Well, I've never thought about really making a living at it and all that. I said, you know, somebody's got to buy apples, and there's applesauce that's got to be made, and there's apple pies that have got to be made. And it's like if you get your bliss, if you know what it is, then it's just a matter of taking some of the risks that go with it. And why not? Why restrict yourself in any way? What I was suggesting to him was, like, give yourself a chance at that. You see this, some of you do, this piece of silver tape here. And this analogy is very important to me. And we're to just say to yourself, okay, this is your birth. And this line represents all of your life, the whole of it. Okay? And this is death over here. Right here. Now, I call that, in my writing, your life mile, because I don't have a better term for it. Just your life mile. All right? Now, in that life mile, for some of you, it's going to be short. For others of you, it'll be 100 years or more. For some, it'll be 30. For some, it'll be 70, whatever. No one knows that. Although I guarantee you it'll be a lot longer if you think healthier and adopt some of the things I'm talking about tonight. But in the vast majority of your life, the big hunk,
There are a set of rules and guidelines and things that you have to master and memorize and get a hold of that will work for you. I call that big chunk the vast majority of your life until you get right to here, right here, right there. There's 1 inch in this space. 5,279 feet, 11 inches of your life up to here, and here, what I think of as the critical inch, because it symbolizes such a tiny proportion of your life. The big chunk of your life, the rules are like this. Most of you have already memorized them, mastered them, and lived them. They are, do what you're supposed to do, obey the rules, listen to other people, go to school, get good grades, pass your courses, don't give your teachers a hard time, get into college if you can. If you can't, go out and get yourself a job. Go out and get yourself some training. Make money. Bring home a paycheck. Get married. Raise a family. Have children. Do the things that you're supposed to do. Please other people as much as you possibly can. Pay your bills on time. Stay out of trouble. Don't go to jail. Dress nice. Go to parties. Have a few drinks. Do all of the things that will make your life work. I am not putting any of that down. It works. We have the greatest society in the world. I am not here to put it down. I love it. I love being a part of it. I appreciate my freedom. But over here, in the critical inch, let's call that your sense of purpose, your sense of mission as a human being in your life. In the critical inch, the rules are exactly the opposite as they are for the big chunk of your life. Exactly the opposite. You can do all of those things that I've just described, all of those rules, and memorize them and get through them and be good and please other people and all, and you will get through your life with a minimum of trouble and stay out of jail and so on. I guarantee you it is impossible to have a sense of purpose in your life by following those rules. Not possible. You cannot have a sense of purpose by pleasing other people. The rules over here say, save for the future. Think about when you retire. Think about your goals and your objectives. That's wonderful, and it helps, and if you've got kids going to college and all these things, you have to do some of that. But it won't give you a sense of purpose, a sense of meaning, a sense of mission in your life. A sense of mission comes from learning the exact opposite rules that work over here. And part of my mission is to change this inch into the big chunk and make those other rules the insignificant inch of your life. If you try to get a sense of purpose by living your life through your children, you will always be frustrated, even though you'll be a wonderful parent. By definition, you cannot feel fulfilled by someone else's accomplishments. You can only stand back and vicariously watch them. But you can't get an internal glow, sense of what you're doing here on this planet. I, without exaggeration, believe nothing is more important to you as a human being than having a daily sense of purpose or mission about your life. Everybody I've ever met, when I get past all of the defenses, wants to feel significant, unique, special, important as a human being. You can't do it by living in the future. The critical inch, you live now, today. You live in this moment. In the big chunk, you live in the past or you live in the future. In the critical inch, you literally allow yourself the freedom to enjoy a moment. Or in the big chunk, you postpone that gratification, that joy. Over here in the big chunk, money, prestige, power, promotions, awards, things like that, give you a sense of purpose. Over here, inner, what you feel about yourself. How you evaluate what you are as a human being gives you a sense of purpose. These other things pay your mortgages. These other things give you things to put on your wall. Those are nice. But they don't give you an inner sense of purpose. We all want to leave footprints in one way or another. And transcending the rules over here, getting out of more, getting out of more, 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 better, 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 getting out of panic, getting out of inertia, getting out of striving, getting out of those things is what this is about over here. And it's different. It's really different. Over here, you consult your outer signals, your external signals, all the things outside of yourself. Over here, inner signals. What do you believe? Over here, you get up in the morning and you go to that job. And you know in your heart that you no longer feel fulfilled in it. You know you've mastered it. You know how to do it. You've done it for 20 years or 30 years or 4 months or whatever. The challenge of it is no longer there. The fulfillment that you once felt in it is not there anymore. It is drill. Drill. One, two, three, four. It's drill. Drill is not fulfilling. It just keeps you automatically responding the way you've been doing for the external paycheck, which you turn in, and the inner peace that you want isn't there. Well, in the critical inch, you get out of that. You leave that. I know what you think. All of the responsibilities, all of the risks, all of that. But I'm not talking about that right now. I'm talking about how you feel about yourself. We can talk about the results. Most people who take the risks do better than they ever did before in all of the traditional payoffs that they think of as important. They end up making more money even though they're not looking for it. They end up with more personal things in their lives, better relationships in their lives, more time for the things that are important, which is spending time with your children and loved ones and so on. Henry David Thoreau said about success, he said, if one advances confidently in the direction of his own dreams and endeavors to live the life which he has imagined, he will meet with a success unexpected in common hours. You know what that means? To me, that means, it makes me shiver just to say it. It means when you take the risks and advance confidently to do the things that mean something to you, not to pay your bills, not to be the good supporter or the good wife or husband or father or mother, advancing confidently, living your life your way, that success, ironically, follows you in ways that you've never dreamt were possible before. But when you chase success, paychecks, more money, bigger vacations, blah, blah. When you do that, then you are living right and you're getting by and doing all the things you're supposed to. But in here, there is no inner peace. And when you lack, as a human being, inner peace, you lack a reason for living. You lack a sense of purpose.
That since I've been on this planet, it seems to me that what I showed up here for has something to do with teaching self-reliance. I haven't been able to escape it at any time in my life. When I was a little boy living in foster homes and in orphanages, when the new children would come in, they would always come and say, "Where's Wayne?" And they'd go find me someplace, and some little girl would be crying or whatever, and they'd say, "Wayne, why don't you take this little girl and show her?" And I'd take her away, and I'd say, "It's a great place, and you're going to have... so it's a great time here, and you're going to learn, and there's no parents here. I mean, this is fantastic. There's nobody telling you what to do all the time." And this was 4, 5, 6, 7 years of age, and I've been doing it ever since. When I was in high school, I did it. When I was in the military, I was giving courses on epistemology and self-directedness, just volunteering. I would get 30, 40 guys in the Navy coming to the classes, and we would discuss these kinds of things. I was helping people who were having to deal with the system there. I was writing essays and even novels when I was a teenager, always about these kinds of issues of self-reliance. I've been living this stuff all my life. It's almost as if this is a deeper, more purposeful part of what my life is here for. This is what I showed up here for. And when you get tuned into that, and that becomes your overriding concern, you have like an overriding spiritual kind of objective, this deep desire, and all of the other little petty things that begin to show up in your life are just minor distractions.
Got my PhD in 1970. That year, I did a job interview that was an opening that a friend of mine said, just do this job interview. It's great. It's for the vice president of a community college. And I said, all right. It was like triple what I was making at that time. But what I was doing at that time was I was teaching, and I was doing some great research projects. I was teaching at a university, which I loved being there in that environment. I had a practice, which was terrific, a counseling practice. But this idea of being the vice president, I was 30 years old, of a college and having all of the things that go with a vice, it was just too appealing to my ego. And I went in and I did the interview. And there was a long interview process at this particular community college in Michigan. First, I had to meet with a group of students, and they all thought it was great having a guy who's just out of his 20s be the vice president of the school. And I was cool. You know, they liked that. Then I had to be interviewed by the faculty, and the faculty all thought that I was terrific. Then I went to the administration, and the administrators weren't quite sure about whether they wanted some young upstart to be coming in there, and so you had to get 3 out of 3. Well, I got 2 out of 3. I got the faculty and the student vote, but the administration vote wasn't, and it got down to myself and another man whose last name is Cunningham, and I believe he's still in that position. And it went all the way down to I passed all of the different criteria, and they removed all of the other people and all of the interview process, and it was going on for months. And it came down to 2 people. And I didn't get it. And he did. And at the time that happened, I was really kind of surprised. But there was a part of me that was relieved, because I kept thinking, I'm going to have to go to committee meetings. I'm going to have to put on a tie and a suit. And I'm going to have to go in there every day. And even though I was going to be making 3 times as much money, and I was going to have all of this sort of prestige thing over here, what I really wanted to be doing over here was going to have to be put aside in the name of these ego things. And I thought what I wanted was these things that my ego was telling me. But somehow the divine intelligence knew better. And I came in second. And as a result, I went and applied for a job at a university in New York, doing what I loved doing, teaching and having my own practice. And the rest of the story is the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey would say.
A long time ago, when I wrote a book that I believed in, and I tried everything to get it published, and I finally did, and then I found out that I don't have any advertising budget. I've got $375 from a publisher to spend any way I want to, and that includes all travel expenses to go out and make this book into a bestseller. So I, at that point in my life, as a man in my mid-30s, was willing to do what it took at that time, and it wasn't like I had to struggle. It wasn't like it was some difficult decision that I had to make. This is what I believed in. This is what I loved, what I wanted to do. And I was willing to do it. Willing to go in and tell the dean at a major university where I was about to have tenure that I am resigning? Yes, if that's what it takes. Willing to go out and talk to everybody in this country and every city and sleep in the back seat of my car and pay for all the expenses myself and hire somebody as a publicist to do it all for me, because I was told over and over again that the only way that you can talk to everybody in America is to get on all of the fancy Tonight shows and the Donahue shows and the Today show and the Tomorrow show and all of that. But nobody wanted me because nobody had ever heard of this person. There's another way to reach everybody in America. It's easier to get on the network television shows, I must admit, because you just get on and everybody's watching, and that's the easy way. There's something missing there when they don't want you. When you call that show over and over again, they say, Wayne who? Then there's another way to do it, and that is you got to go to everybody in America. Are you willing to do it? It's going to take 2 years. And you're going to have to quit your job and your practice, and you're going to have to take your family out on the road, and you're going to have to spend a lot of time alone, and you're going to have to invest some of your own money, and you're going to have to go out there and do every little dinky radio and television show across the country in order to reach everybody. Are you willing to do it? The answer for me was an enthusiastic, exciting, absolutely yes. And had the time of my life doing it, advancing confidently in the direction of my own dreams, endeavoring to live the life which I had imagined. And success, it just creeps right into your house and creeps right into your consciousness as a result of going out there and doing and believing what you want to. The same principle applies right here. Are you willing?
Willingness is perhaps the most important word you can learn on your road to real magic and manifesting miracles for yourself. The question always that I ask people is, how willing are you to make your thoughts, your dreams, your visualizations, your images, your invisibleness, that's what all those things are, how willing are you to allow those things to become reality in the physical world? In the world of form. And when people say, well, I tried what you suggested and I thought about it and I really visualized it and I got the image and all of that and it didn't work out, I always say to them, what weren't you willing to do? Where did you stop? Because life gives exams and those exams keep coming at you and the challenges will keep coming at you and all of the things that are continuing to come at you are challenges and opportunities. And are there exactly because they're supposed to be. It's all, the whole universe is exquisitely synchronized. It's all operating in its own perfection. And you have to see all of these events and all of these things that you'd have judged to be failures and all of these things that you thought were obstacles or all of the events that you thought were horrible or blissful or beautiful, whatever they're all supposed to be there. There's no accidents at the subatomic level. The tiniest little quarks that there are in the subatomic field, every one of them is on purpose. It may look like chaos, but it's not. And so is everything that comes into your life. God's plan works. Yours doesn't. By and large, that's a summary. And you have to be willing to connect to that grand design, that grand plan, and willingness is like a student who is ready knows that anything that shows up is something that you can say, I'll look into that. I'll check that out. It is somebody saying, well, you know, you might try this, and instead of you saying, no, I've tried that, that doesn't work, you stop and you say, yeah, I'm ready now. I'm ready to give that an effort. A student who is ready is a learner who is willing. A student who is ready is a learner. Not a teacher, but a learner who is ready. And that readiness, that willingness to take what comes into your life and say, I'm going to fly with it. I'm going to do something with that. Even as you're listening to some of the things that you're going to hear in this tape, some of them will undoubtedly sound outrageous to you. And if you want to hang on to your truth and stay there, that's absolutely fine. But it will not allow you to transcend and get into another level of what I'm calling real magic. And it isn't that I'm right and you're wrong. None of this is about right and wrong. If anybody has any suggestions or thoughts to me, and I get letters by the thousands weekly from people who offer me suggestions on how to say this, or maybe it wouldn't be that, or somebody send me a pamphlet about this is what this meant to me, or why don't you read that book or whatever. And I have a huge file in my office where I take those things and I put them in there and I go through them periodically and I will send my secretary over to order these different books that people have recommended and I've shifted many of my perceptions and beliefs based just upon being willing to hear something new and to have someone explain it in a different way. Unlearning the big lie. The big lie is that you are limited and that doubt and fear are the way that you learn things. Is by having that willingness. I don't think there's any more key word than willingness or readiness in your entire vocabulary. Being willing to try something new. Most of the things that don't work for you in your life, the relationship that didn't work, the bankruptcy or the lack of prosperity in your life, the fact that you didn't make the team or you didn't pass the test, the fact that you weren't able to overcome the flu or you developed some kind of overweight problem or some kind of addictive problem that you have in your life. Most of those things, or virtually all of those things, are the result of your being unwilling or not ready to be a student. Not ready, just simply not ready. The addict who continues to use drugs or to use alcohol or to smoke cigarettes, it isn't that they don't have the willpower, it isn't that they don't have the capacity, it isn't that they're inferior in any way, it isn't that they've inherited bad nicotine genes or bad alcohol genes or bad cocaine genes. It has nothing to do with that. It is, I still am not willing. Because when it boils down to it, you can go to every self-help group in the world. You can go to the 12 steps, 50 steps, 100 steps. You can put patches on your arm. You can go through all of the difficulties and the stages of your addictions. But by and large, when it gets right down to how do I change a behavior to become more magical as a human being, you have to do it yourself. You have to, in the bottom line, in the end, you have to be willing. And willingness doesn't mean I tried it and it didn't work and it was too tough for me. What you're really saying in that moment is that I was willing to do it for an hour, but I wasn't willing to do it for an hour and 1 minute. I wasn't willing. The student who is willing to not be tired, is willing to be healthy, is willing to be happy, is willing to be wealthy, is willing to be in great relationships, is willing to have virtually anything.
Most of the things that you envision that are going to be terrible, all the disasters that you think are going to befall you as a result of taking that risk and taking that chance, they're all in your head. When you get out there and do it, you try the new job, you get out of that relationship, or you go to work at improving it. You move on to another part of the country or another part of the world that is something you've always wanted to do, and you do it. And you get out there and you struggle and you try it. You may not even make as much money. Chances are you will. Probably more. Most people find out that they are doing even better when they have more of a sense of personal mission about themselves. But whatever it is, there's no price tag you can put on how you feel each day when you're doing something that is important to you. A very good example of that is Jess Lehrer, who has written books I'm sure that many of you have read. I Ain't Perfect, or whatever it is. I May Not Be Well, but pretty soon I'm going to get things under control, or whatever the hell its titles are. Had a heart attack. He was working as an executive and so on, had a heart and came close to dying, and decided that he'd always wanted to go out into Montana. He always wanted to raise horses. And he did it. He just took the risk and went out there, and he wanted to write, and he started writing. And before long, he was doing 100% better than he had ever done before. The person you are looking at right now is a classic example of that. I was a college professor. I was working as a therapist in New York. I was doing a lot of workshops and things like that. But the idea of going into work and working for somebody else every day of my life just didn't give me the sense of purpose that I felt I wanted. And I was able to take a tenured position at a major university as a professor and say, I don't want that. I'm going to go out and I'm going to write and I'm going to talk to people. I'm going to go on television. I'm going to make this thing happen. And those of you who knew me long before, you know, I became famous and so on, know that that was something I announced to everyone, to all of my classes and so on. I'm going to go out there and make it happen. And every publisher and everybody in the field who told me what the world needs least of all right now is another self-help book, and we certainly don't need another psychologist telling us how to live, and all of those things, couldn't have cared less. And when they told me I couldn't get on the network television because I was an unknown, I said, fine, then I'll go on a little 5-watt station in WBAB in Babylon, New York. And that's where I did my very first interview and went to little cities. They wouldn't let me here in Detroit do interviews, so I went to Toledo and I went to Columbus and I went to places where I could just get on a radio station and talk all night. And when they said, you're not going to have books in those cities, I said, that's no problem, I'll take them with me. When they said, we're not going to do a second printing, I said, send me the whole first printing, 1,500 books. Asked my wife. They were all delivered right to our garage one day, 1,500 books. And I said, well, we're not going to do a second printing. I said, well, you don't have any first printing. It's all sold out. I bought them. Which is exactly what I did. True story. It was a matter of never once in my life wavering from the idea. And I borrowed money to buy those books. I didn't have a whole lot of money. I would do anything to go out there and make it happen. When we went into a place in Columbus, Ohio, telling this is really interesting. This is on television forever. I would go on a radio show and give a talk and talk for 2 hours. And people would say, where can we get your book? I had a list. My wife had already gotten a list of where all the bookstores were in that city. And I announced. I said, you can get them at the bookmark bookstore over here and this bookstore over there. And pretty soon they were getting phone calls for the books. And they didn't have the books, of course. They weren't there. It wasn't even a known book at that time. Then I would arrive there with my little truck and my books. And they said, my God, we've had 14 requests for that book already. Where is it? I said, well, do you want me to leave you a couple of cases of them? And then if you don't sell them, you can send them. Why, sure, they had them all sold out. I became my own distributor. In other words, did that all across the country. And when September came along, after doing a couple of thousand of interviews, all-night interviews, driving between cities, going out there and spending money that I didn't even have, finally, The Tonight Show, after hundreds and hundreds of efforts, called me, said, we'd like to have you come on. And you know what everybody said? Boy, were you lucky. You hit it just at the right time, you know? Things just worked out for you. And they don't understand that anyone that you ever know, Adolph Rupp said this, the old basketball coach at the University of Kentucky, that anyone you ever meet who's at the top didn't just land there. They worked and worked and struggled to get there. And don't take, by the way, that very same concept of what it means to struggle and deny it to your own children. So many parents I know who can remember earning their own nickels and dimes and quarters, shoveling snow, you remember, fighting over who was going to get the snow shovel, and going out and hustling jobs, trying to cut grass and so on. A lot of us can remember earning our own nickels, dimes, and quarters, and have children who expect to drive sports cars, or want $200 fry boots, or expect to have baton twirling lessons and mama pick them up and take them everywhere. And the old notion of you give a man a fish and he eats for a day, you teach a man to fish and he'll eat for a lifetime. There's a whole lot of truth for me in it. Don't deny your children the very thing that made you the successful person that you are. Let them have some struggle. Let them be allowed to go out and work.
The ability to cultivate your own garden, what a powerful notion that is, written about so beautifully by Voltaire and Candide. The preoccupation with being in other people's garden and tilling their soil and looking at what they're creating keeps us off of our purpose, keeps us off of fulfilling our human destiny, what we're here for, what we're about. Enjoying life and helping others to do that. As long as you're focused on what other people are doing or should or shouldn't be doing, you're allowing their conduct or their behavior or their activities to control your life. That borders on immorality to me, because you've got a free will and you've got God with you at all times. To give that will over to someone else is like abdicating your very divinity, your very humanity. And when you abdicate that, you turn yourself into a lesser being. What your goal is to not allow other people's conduct or activities to be in charge of you, for you to be in charge of you and to know your purpose and to be fulfilling it. And if other people don't like the way that you are choosing to do that, then that just has to be in the way of things. That's just the way it is, and that's fine. If it can't be fine, then you have to stop and assess and look at yourself and say, why am I allowing other people's opinions or behavior or conduct to interfere with my own fulfillment or my own happiness? And know that that's what you're doing at the time that you're finding yourself upset with other people's poking their nose into your garden. And then you find yourself not poking your nose into their garden as well, because when you're on purpose, when you are living your life and conducting yourself in terms of loving and giving and sharing, then you're not on outcome. You're not at all concerned about
whether this person likes that or not. I have found that one of the major, major changes for me in the past 5 or 6 years has been my almost indifference to what people think of what I'm doing. I find that I write now, when I write, on purpose, not on outcome. There was a time, I think, when I was more on outcome, on what's it going to look like, how's it going to sell, how's it going to do, how, and so on. And now I'm not on that at all. And it's interesting that as I get off of those outer concerns in my writing, that my writing really picks up and really improves and flows much better. I find that when I go before an audience and speak, that since I've let go of my notes and not concerned myself with outcome and with whether I'm going to be liked and how well I'm going to be received and all of that, I can be much more authentic when I'm on stage, when I'm talking, and which consequently results in my performance being, I think, much better than it was. And it isn't that I'm a better performer, it's that I'm on purpose. And I'm not concerning myself with all of the worrisome things that you can never get an answer to. That is, how is everybody going to like me and how am I being received and all of that sort of thing. So, more and more in my life, it isn't that I've made a decision, all right, now that I'm enlightened, I no longer am going to be concerned about what other people think of me. It's that it just simply doesn't occur to me any longer to be consumed with what other people think of what I'm doing. And the reverse of that, which is really nice, is that I'm not concerned about what other people are doing. I mean, I'm grateful that there are people out there who are doing a lot of the things that I would find just treacherous to do. I mean, emotionally treacherous, like being an accountant, for example, or working at a computer, or maybe being a chef, or driving a truck. Those are all things that I just couldn't imagine myself. If somebody said, you have to do it, I'm sure I could turn it into something positive for myself, but I'm so grateful that there are people out there who like to work at computer terminals and who like to work with figures. And so whenever I need a computer person, I'm always grateful. We're building a house right now, and we had to have a meeting with the architect just last week, and it was one of the most interesting meetings. I just kept sitting there. My wife said, when it was over, she said, you know, you were rude in that meeting. I said, what are you talking about? She said, you never said anything. You just sat there and looked at him and asked him questions all the time, and they had nothing to do with our house. I said, you take care of the house. I know that the house will be just whatever you want it to be. I just know it will be, you know, because you're so good at that, you know. So that doesn't concern me at all. I was really only at the meeting because you asked me to be there. I said, but when I saw this guy who could reverse a swimming pool that was going to be built a certain way, and he could take it and he could turn it upside down and draw it on a piece of paper and then set it in over here, or he could take this room and say, no, aesthetically, this isn't going to work. We're going to have this over there. And it all worked. And then he would program it in on his little computer and then push this button and it would all come out exactly. I said, I was just so fascinated that there are human beings that can do that, that I just wanted to know more. And then I said, could I go back and see this, that computer, how that works and how you print that out? And he took me on a whole tour of his office. Meantime, I didn't give him any answers to any of the questions they had about the house meeting. When you are cultivating your own garden and not concerned with others, you just look at other people's gardens and you say, wow, this is his whole life. And look at how good he is at this. And he can just shift this around and he can do all of that. And my brain just doesn't work that way. It just doesn't work that way any more than if I, and I told him that, I said, how would you like it if I gave you a microphone and 5,000 people and told you, go out there and talk to them for 3 hours? He said, I'd collapse. I said, or if I gave you 500 blank sheets of paper and I said, fill them and write a book. He said, I couldn't. I said, well, that's just exactly the way I feel about what you're doing. And yet I honor it. I mean, I celebrate it. To me, this is a genius that someone could do something like that. And that's the way to cultivate your own garden.
I remember being in New York City and doing an interview not too long ago, and it was a radio station that had just changed formats. And they had gone from talk radio, which I had done many interviews at this station over the years, to gospel music. And so everybody that was on the staff at this radio station, some 30 people, were all told the day that I was coming there to do an interview that they had all been let go. And everybody was walking around, and they were all depressed, and they were all upset. And every time someone would come up to me and say, "Oh, Wayne, isn't this awful? I've been here for 22 years, and I just lost my job," and I'd say, "Congratulations." And they'd look and say, "What's the matter with you? Why? How could you believe in congratulations? I just lost my job." And I said, "Yes, but within a certain amount of time, probably within a year, you'll be in a place that is much better than where you are now." And it was almost like God was trying to tell you something, but you wouldn't listen. It's time to change. It's time to walk down another street. What is your dream? And you sit down with each one of these people and you ask them, "What would you really like to be doing rather than working here at this particular..." And then most of them said, "I'd like to have my own business, or I would like to do some writing over here. I've always had some ideas about writing." One guy said that he wanted to just do an opera. He'd always wanted, and he's been working on an opera like Mr. Holland, remember, in Mr. Holland's Opus. But he could never get himself the courage to do it because he was always going into the radio station every day in New York. And then I saw him about a year and a half after that, and he was getting his opera published, which he couldn't have done if... It's like this intelligence that we think is conspiring against us is something that we have to understand works with us. But you have to have infinite patience and trust. And when you have... And the reason it says infinite patience produces immediate results, the reason it says this is because the immediate result of your infinite patience is peace. You retreat in peace, and you let the universe handle the detail. And after all, that's what it's about, living your life at peace.
It almost always ends up being a very frustrating experience for people when they demand something. There's two concepts here that are very important. One is the question of willing something to happen. All right, on August the 13th, if there really is a God, or if this really works, then I will get the phone call that will give me the biggest break of my life on August the 13th, and that's the way it's going to be. Or maybe even in just some small way, like on September 15th, I will get rid of this wart that's on my nose or something. So it's like willing things to happen in the universe. That will lead you to frustration and disbelief and an absence of faith. And the awakened life, or looking at life from the enlightened perspective that I'm talking about and discovering this inner universe, will always be like just outside of your grasp if you're testing God or testing the universe in some way. So that's like willing things to happen. Just through the power of my will, I can make it happen. The second principle here is what I call being willing. In this case, it's different than willing something to be. This is called being willing for it to be. And that is a whole new way of testing the universe. It isn't making a demand. It isn't, if I can get this bird to land over here on this branch and that's going to be the signal that I'm looking for. It isn't anything like that, because the universe doesn't work that way. And it is like, I am now going to be willing to allow what it is that I want to happen to happen. I'm going to be willing. I'm not going to demand anything. I'm not going to ask anything special for it to happen. I'm just going to be willing. People ask over and over again, is it practical to follow your bliss in a world which demands payment of mortgages and electric bills and phone bills and so on? The answer to that for me, I can only speak from my own experience, is that if you think abundance, abundance will rain into your life. But there's also the whole business about how addicted are you to your way of life, to the belief that you have to have the kind of bills that you have. Thoreau, when he went to Walden, said, "Simplify, simplify, simplify. Let the affairs of your life number one and two, rather than large numbers." So you have choices here too. One of the choices is that you're going to simplify your life. and you're going to reduce the amount of external pressures that are put on you in the way of expenses. And it's quite easy to simplify. We don't think that it is, but all you have to do is look back in your life to the times when it was simpler, when you didn't have to have somebody to come in and do all the things that you're paying people to do. When you were more in charge of your life, that's one option. And it's an option that I exercise more and more in my life. There's another option, and the other option is to absolutely believe that whatever level of income that you have now, you're capable of having in the area of your own bliss. And believing that, and taking the risks that go with it. So the answer to whether or not you can pay your bills, the answer to that is in your own history. If you've always been a person who has paid your bills, then you're not going to suddenly become a person who becomes irresponsible and has to go on welfare. If you've been a person who's never been responsible about paying your bills, then you probably won't pay them even when you're following your bliss. See, a lot of people will look at their whole history of their life, 25, 30, 40, 50 years of living, and see that they've always been responsible, and then have images in their mind of becoming irresponsible if they do something different. Instead of relying upon that whole history, that whole long catalog of historical responsibility that has been your life, instead you come up with this enormous, horrible image that suddenly I'm not going to be able to do those things any longer. And I would much rather rely on my whole history of responsibility. And I have found that people who haven't been responsible in their life, it isn't because they're not doing the kind of work that they love or whatever. It is because that's what they have learned. That's what they've adopted as a lifestyle. And they walk out on their bills, and they do it when they're 14, and they do it when they're 30, and they're broke when they retire. And they blame life and circumstances and the breaks and all of the things that so many people blame for the conditions of their lives. And the people who have been responsible stay that way, regardless of whether they're raising horses, which is what they want to do, instead of, working in the city, or vice versa, working in the city instead of raising horses. For those who have real logical sort of left brain minds, the dilemma is always, if I'm acting out a script, and the script has already been written, and there's an intelligence about this, and that everything happens for a reason, then I must not have a free will, and therefore I'll just sort of sit back and sit in a cave and allow the world to transpire and allow my life to take place, and I'm really not in charge of it. You know, that's the great dilemma that a lot of people face until they get to the point where they realize that both things are operating at the same time. And you have to live with that duality or that polarity of being in charge and not being in charge, of being doomed to make choices. You learn to live with that paradox. It's the reason for the smirk on the face of the Buddha. You know, it's the, when you get used to it and live with it, it becomes almost delicious and exciting to know that you are at the same moment acting out a much grander scheme, and at the very same moment you're making all the choices within it all at the same time. And you can fight with that one forever and not get any place with it. What I suggest is that you know that every step along the way that you're making, along the path, all the obstacles, all the things that you're going through at this moment, that what you do is you start to process them a little bit differently. And process them not in terms of why do I have to do this, and why isn't my life working out, or why are things so negative and so on, but process it a little differently in that, why am I choosing this, why am I participating in this now, what do I have to get out of this, what is the lesson in it for me? And as you do that, you find yourself moving more and more towards the gate. And then when you come up to the gate, you just sort of slam it shut behind you, and you never look back again. And that's when you know that you're not alone. That's when you know that for whatever help that you are looking for, or whatever guidance you're seeking, or whatever road you want to travel, that there's another world other than the world of the five senses. How do you find your bliss? The answer to that is you don't. You have to let your bliss find you. And your bliss can't find you. I mean, it sounds strange, but your bliss cannot find you. like your purpose. It cannot find you as long as you're filled up or clogged up with something else. Here's a wonderful story. There was an expert on Buddhism and Far Eastern religions, and he was a professor at a university. And he had written 4 or 5 books on the subject. And he was really considered a true expert. But he had always wanted to meet a particular Zen saint who lived in India. And so he traveled there with all of his books and with all of his... And he wanted to meet this particular Zen saint, a guru. And when he got there, he introduced himself. He had made an appointment and he introduced himself. And the man was had just like a loincloth on, and he was very simple, very peaceful, very old, and the expert began talking to him about all the things that he knew about Zen and Buddhism and so on. And the master stopped him and said, "Would you like a cup of tea?" And he said, "Yes, that would be very nice." And so he took a teacup and put it in a saucer, and the man continued to talk about all of the things that he knew about. And the master picked up the tea, and he began to pour it into the cup. And the man continued talking. And then the cup was full, and the master continued to pour. And the tea poured out of the cup and onto the saucer. And as the man talked, he still kept pouring. And the tea was now going onto the floor and onto the man's pants. And finally, he stopped him, and he said, "Excuse me, but the cup is full. You're pouring, you know, and it's full." And he said... And the master stopped him and said, "You are like the cup." He said, "You are so full of everything that you know that you don't have room to let anything else new in." And so many of us are just like that teacup. We're so full of all of the stuff that we have learned and that we've... There's no more room to let anything else in. It's just all pouring out and just going past us and all outside of us. Now, if you can see that metaphor in yourself, you can begin to see that in the eyes of the beginner, there are millions of options. In the eyes of the expert, there are only one or two. So the suggestion to finding your bliss is to always be a beginner on the path. Never become an expert. If you're going to go out and learn tennis and you've never played it before, and someone hands you a racket, and they say, "Now, try a drop shot this way." You are open. You are willing. "I'll do that. Now, hit a forehand this way. Now, well, try it this way if you move over here. And now try it." It's like the beginner has 1,000 options available to them and will try everything. But if you talk to an expert about how to hit a backhand, they only know one way. Now, that's true not just in tennis. That's true in your business. That's true in your relationships. That's true in everything in your life. Stay a beginner along the path. You can get clogged up, so clogged up with what you know and with the negativity that goes with that and all the rejection, all the judgment that goes with that, because you have to reject all kinds of other points of view in order to make sure that yours is the only one that ever gets heard or ever gets used, that you don't have any room inside of you for something new and something exciting and something different and expanding yourself and so on. So be wary of experts, especially if you're one yourself. Be wary of yourself becoming one, because then you limit yourself. And by limiting yourself, your bliss, your purpose, which is there, can't find you. It's like an artery that's clogged up with cholesterol. I mean, it just can't flow. Nothing can flow through it because it's too clogged. You've got to unclog yourself. And the way you unclog yourself is by opening yourself up and advancing confidently and doing things that make sense to you, that make you feel good, that are of service to others, that are useful to other people, whatever it is that you're doing.